You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 25th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How's everyone doing? We're on a Tuesday because Kara is flying out of Scotland tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
Woohoo!
Nice. Going to be over the Atlantic for most of the day.
Are you sad, Kara?
I'm also not looking forward to getting on a plane. You know, all the standard COVID fears. But, it's time. Hopefully I'm starting a new practicum soon, which will be really exciting, in an oncology service. And school starts right at the beginning of September for me, which has always been partially online. So it's an easy transition for me. I'm starting my fourth year of my PhD program.
Ooh. Wow. Oh, boy.
What are you going to miss the most besides the haggis?
Us talking about the haggis.
Right, yeah. Like, I will not be missing the haggis. I think I'll be missing the quiet nights. It's very quiet here at night if it's not raining. There are no crickets, which is interesting.
Oh, boy.
Right?
So loud here.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Super loud.
Oh,
man.
I love the crickets.
And there's no traffic noises, so it's really, really silent. And I'll miss the beautiful sunsets and all the sheepies. Mm. It's weird how much you get used to being around farmland, and then going back to LA will be, you know, all concrete and buildings.
And hot.
And fire.
Oh, yeah, fire. Shoot.
Steve, how has the hospital changed over the past 8 months? Like, how has the tone changed or people's attitudes? Are you seeing fatigue?
I wouldn't say fatigue. I mean, we've settled into a new routine. This is now like the new way. Everyone's wearing masks for social distancing. Everything gets wiped down, washed down. Between patients, you know, obsessively Purelling and washing hands. You know, we're just doing it. It's just the job now. Traffic is still a lot less driving to work, I'll tell you that. I mean, you know,
it's
just a lot fewer people going in, you know, which is good. I think it's because we're doing 20% or whatever telehealth. So that's that's how much things have decreased.
Are you doing it from work, your telehealth, or are you doing it from home?
No, I do it from home.
Nice.
Because, you know, we don't want to use a room. I don't want to be there.
Right.
You know? Plus,
and
it's all an increased risk.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the whole part of the point is that we can, you know, make up for slowing everything down by, we can essentially add clinics that are virtual clinics, that are telehealth clinics, without having to use a room.
Right.
Use the limited space that we have. But it's great. The telehealth thing is still awesome. You know, I hope that it doesn't go away.
Who decides that, by the way? I mean, is this more like hospital to hospital, or is it?
No, it's primarily insurance companies. Will they pay for it or not? Right. That's it. It's will they pay for it? If they pay for it, we'll do it. But also, the other issue is states' willingness to allow telehealth for out-of-state people. So, for example, New York just changed their rules. During the shutdown, they would allow telehealth visits out of state. So in other words, a New York resident could see a Connecticut doctor via telehealth and get reimbursed for it. But now they just said, nope, you have to be licensed in New York to see a telehealth patient who's in New York, which is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's their way to, I guess, regulate what the licensing has always been. Like, it's always been that you're licensed in the state where you practice.
Yes.
So all of a sudden,
but if I'm in Connecticut and my patient's in New York, I need to be licensed in both states, I guess.
Ridiculous in New England, especially because it's the difference between your patient driving to your office from New York, where you could see them perfectly legally. But now if you're seeing them while they're in New York, you're crossing state lines.
Well, but it's not for protecting patients. Does New York really think that Connecticut is like Footloose and fancy free licensing physicians? Like, do they really think they're going to weed out anyone who passed the requirements for licensure in Connecticut? Like, it's not adequate. It's ridiculous. It's just they want to collect their license fees.
Of course. Mm. Is there reciprocity? Yeah, I know for psychology, like, you know, you need to be licensed in the state where you practice. And there are a handful of states that have reciprocity with other states so that your license is utilized across those states.
Yeah, there needs to be like almost universal telehealth reciprocity. Or, you know what? Make a telehealth license that's just really easier and cheaper, you know?
Because then you can also be trained in all the privacy practices online, because there are certain rules about using encrypted software and how do you store records that are, you know, legally you do need training in that.
Yeah.
So yeah, just get licensed in telehealth. That's genius.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully we're adapting to the new system, but, you know, right now I'm just mostly seeing patients that are in Connecticut anyway.
You know, shouldn't the government step in and just regulate the insurance companies?
It's all state by state. It's all state by state. That's the way.
Yeah, that's a much bigger question that you're asking right now, Jay.
So the answer is no. The federal government doesn't get involved unless they're involved when it comes to Medicare, Medicaid, VA. You know, the
state run health
company.
Or yeah, right, federally run healthcare,
the federal programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking of such things, I'm sure you guys heard about the snafu at the FDA.
Yeah,
not good. Regarding, this is the new COVID snake oil, which is not really snake oil, but you know.
But it's also still, as of yet, very unproven. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, so we're talking about convalescent plasma.
Right.
Which I can't remember if we've mentioned on the show previously, but the FDA gave an emergency use authorization, an EUA, for convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19. There's essentially two big parts to the criticism. The weaker one is actually the authorization itself.
We didn't need it, but right? Well, basically didn't really even need it. It was already done.
There were already 100,000 people more who received the convalescent plasma. So yeah, it may be counterproductive is the concern, because the bottom line is that convalescent plasma, we'll do this as premise first, it's a perfectly valid treatment for infection, and it's been around for 100 years. You basically take plasma, which contains antibodies, from somebody who's recovered from an illness, and you give it to somebody else who's in the middle of that illness, and it gives them a short-lived protection. So the idea is that you give it to somebody, you know, in the early phases of their COVID-19 illness, and it helps them get over it quickly, and they never go on to develop severe disease. So perfectly valid, but it doesn't always work. You know, it depends on what kind of antibodies are being produced and how effective those antibodies are, et cetera. So you have to test it in each disease.
And if it's, you know, it has to be done in a really not regulated, but systematic way, because there are definitely many examples out there. I was reading an article that was written by an Ebola doctor who basically said, like, I got Ebola. I was treated with convalescent plasma and I got a lot worse because I was in a place where the plasma was not clean.
But even if it's the plasma itself is clean, there's no quality control issue. Mm-hmm. It just we need to understand the complex immunology of COVID-19, right. And it is complex, and it could theoretically make you worse just because of the immune reaction, right?
Right.
And so it needs to be studied. It needs to be studied. And so there's only preliminary, very preliminary data. So one of the criticisms is that the data is too preliminary to do this, to give it the EUA, the emergency use authorization, and that it may hamper research, because who's going to want to go into a study and have a chance of getting placebo when you know you could get the stuff with outside of a clinical trial? So it makes it very hard to do the studies we need to know if it's safe and effective. But the other part of the criticism was the hype surrounding
it. Right, because it's hydroxychloroquine all over again.
Yes, exactly. It was being promoted, of course, and Trump, you know, had a big press conference about it, saying it was a breakthrough, it's a game changer.
From like 200 years ago.
Yeah, right. It's all this ridiculous hyperbole. But the question is, to what extent the FDA itself, which should be a professional, non-political organization that is based entirely on science, how much did they get caught up in the political pressure? Now, there's, you know, a couple of reasons to think that they did get caught up in the political pressure. The first is that not a couple days before that, Trump tweeted about how the FDA is slowing down approval for drugs for COVID-19 just to hurt him politically, which is completely made up witch hunt nonsense, right? But then that, of course, poisons the well. Now, how are we supposed to interpret the FDA's sudden approval of convalescent plasma right on the heels of that tweet? They can insist that it wasn't political, but it certainly makes it seem that way. But the other thing is, and this is probably just a mistake, but it's a bad one, is that the director of the FDA, in promoting convalescent plasma, made a completely basic and horrific mistake in relaying the information. So what there's this one study, which is a preprint study, hasn't been peer reviewed, and from what I'm hearing, may not get approved as is because there are serious problems methodologically. Man. It's a retrospective study, like open label kind of thing, where they may have done a little bit of cherry picking. You know what they say, you do like multiple analyses and you pick the one that shows you some advantage. But it showed that at least in one subgroup of a certain age, like early treatment, less than 80, whatever, like you have to, multiple caveats. In that group, the death rate decreased from 11% to 8%, right? So a 3% decrease. However, there's you guys remember the difference between an absolute risk and a relative risk.
Yeah.
The absolute risk reduction was 3%, 11% to 8%, but the relative risk reduction was 35%, right? 8 is 35% of less than 11.
Right. So it's just a little like statistical magic, and then it looks so, on paper.
So you could say there was a quote-unquote 35% reduction in death rate, and not say if that was absolute or relative and let people make the wrong inference.
This is just like the bacon study. Remember, the bacon gives you six times the cancer rate or whatever.
It was, from 0.01 to 0.06, or whatever. So, but worse than that, he didn't just do that. That would be bad enough for a scientist to do that. And this guy is a cancer researcher. It's not like he's not a scientist. But then he said, that means, this is what's like almost a quote, I'm paraphrasing here, that means if 100 people who had COVID, 35 fewer people will have died if they received. So he described it specifically as if the 35% were an absolute risk reduction instead of a relative risk reduction. It's only three fewer people. He exaggerated it by over tenfold. And
the press ran with it?
Well, there was an immediate reaction among scientists, like, whoa. I mean, like, he got immediately massively criticized. And to his credit, I mean, what else could he say? He's like, the criticism is completely valid. I screwed up. It was a mistake. It's 3%.
Wait.
All right. Hopefully damage wasn't done.
Are you saying
meantime.
He didn't double and triple down? Does that even happen anymore?
I mean, we're talking about math here. There's like nothing to say. What could you say? This is math.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And he's a scientist.
Really? That's why you couldn't double down, because it's math?
Oh, but he is a scientist, and we're talking.
Well, okay.
And his criticism came from science. Like, if you said 1 + 1 = 3, and like, no, it's 2. Are you going to double down on 1 + 1 = 3?
Okay. Some people would, but I'm just happy that to hear people not doubling down, because that's pretty much all I've been hearing for.
So the Politicos were just going with the 35% reduction and not clarifying, but he clarified. He clearly thought that it was a absolute risk reduction the way he described it. So, you know, come on, you don't go before the press on something so politically charged, especially with this pall of political manipulation hanging over you without all your ducks in a row. That was a massive fail.
Massive
fail.
That's pretty bad.
Should he resign?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Steve, what's going to happen to him?
I don't know. Probably nothing, you know. I don't have any reason to think that anything's going to happen to him. So it is what it is at this point. The convalescent plasma has an EUA. It's going to get used. We don't have the science to back it up. It's going to be harder to do the research. It's going to live in limbo, you know, for a while.
It may never get peer
review. And it's nothing new, guys. I mean, you know, my ex is a nurse. She's been in the ICU since like February or March working with this. She's like, we've been using that since like the end of March, approximately.
Right.
This is not a new thing.
No, I've heard about it since the beginning. Yeah.
And Steve, like, is the idea that generally convalescent plasma is kind of used as like a last ditch treatment?
I mean, they were using it. No, because you have to use it early in the disease, actually.
You do.
It doesn't work.
Okay.
It doesn't work if you give it later in the disease. It's just it's what we call like an empirical treatment. Like, you're doing it because it makes sense even before you have specific clinical data. And so when patients are sick, it's a generally safe and may work kind of treatment.
Right.
But you still need to study it. You need to study specifically COVID-19 convalescent plasma and know who should get it, when should they get it, how much should they get, how much does it work, what are the risks. And until you know that, you're shooting blind.
And not just that. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong here, because this is just kind of a hunch, but it seems to me like it's probably kind of an unsustainable treatment. Like,
well, that's the other question.
It requires a person to donate plasma who's actually recovered from the disease.
Yes. So, yes, but you can treat three people for every one donor.
Oh, okay. That's
good. So, yeah, it's not one for one. But still, you need everyone, basically, who's recovering to donate their plasma.
Right. Yeah. And that's only if they're, you know, healthy people with healthy plasma. Because there's probably a lot of people whose plasma you couldn't use if they have other diseases.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Only so many, not everybody could donate. And they have to be, you know, in the convalescent phase, but healthy enough to donate. Like if they're like still in the ICU, but the infection's gone, that's not going to work.
Right.
So there's a limited pool of people who could donate. But, you know, if you're giving it to the people who are most at risk, you know, again, if you're using it optimally, it's one more treatment. It's not a game changer. It's just one more treatment in our arsenal that can work.
And was there anything preventing, like, are there any legal restrictions from people already using it? Like, why do we need FDA approval?
So they were using it basically off-label. You know, they were they're using it as a procedure.
But that's not illegal.
No, it's perfectly fine. It's legal. It's ethical. It could in fact be appropriate science based medicine, as long as you have the evidence to support it and you have a reasonable clinical rationale. The risk versus benefit you can defend. It makes sense.
Right. You do that until there's enough really solid evidence, and once the evidence becomes solid enough for the FDA to officially approve it, then you go through the motions to do that.
Yeah.
Everyone's under stress and enormous pressure to find solutions to this problem as
fast as
possible.
But it's weird because it's a solution that already exists. It's like they're codifying something that is already totally legal to do, but now they're saying all of a sudden it's safe and effective, which we don't know if it is.
The one thing that's clear in all this is that Trump is using this for political purposes. There's no question about that.
No doubt.
That's where the hype and the controversy is coming from. That's why this fumble on the FDA director's part was so bad, is because it's being made political. But outside of that, the scientific questions are pretty straightforward. We need to test it, and we shouldn't. You know, we should be using it as part of a clinical trial, right? If the thing is, if you make it impossible to do research, then we're never going to know if it works or not.
Yeah, come on, you can't do these shortcuts. You can't skip steps.
The meta story here is that, you know, while we're in a rush to develop treatments for COVID-19, we can't sacrifice confidence in the system.
Right.
Yeah. And like when a vaccine comes out, we can't have people saying, well, this was rushed to approval. You know, we can't trust the FDA. Look what they put through that, you know, convalescent plasma. We now know that doesn't work. You know, so if we don't do it right, then you know, the public loses confidence. And that's a big part of the game. You know,
there's both short-term and long-term problems with it.
Yeah. So the whole thing was a CF. It's unfortunate. But again, it's the convalescent plasma in and of itself is a reasonable treatment. It has a 100-year history behind it. It's just that we have to study it in this specific disease.
Sure.
Did you just say it was a CF, like it was a cluster F?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
It's a CDCF.
I've never heard somebody say that. What a CF. I'm going to start doing that.
Oh, you haven't heard that? But CCF. Huh. You know what CCF
means? That's a CFAF. Come on.
It's an FDACF.
All right. Let's move on to some news items. Jay, some good news about recyclable plastics.
Steve, before we get to the good news, I'm going to have to talk about trash.
Yeah.
You know, garbage.
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 Just rubbish. To set the stage so people can appreciate this news item a little bit more. First off, as we know, plastic pollution, it's been growing. And it's becoming this significant problem around the world. We're producing about 290 million tons of plastic each year. And in the U.S., for example, only about 10% of it is legitimately being recycled. And recycled doesn't mean dealt with. Recycled means reused, melted down, repurposed, right? Not put in the ground.
And goes right back out into the environment again.
Yeah.
Right. And you can only do that so many times.
Yeah, so the remaining plastic that's burned, it's buried, or it's clogging the environment, which is disgusting and with horrible consequences. So recycling plastics is more a fantasy than a reality as it is right now. The items that typically get recycled are cardboard and paper, plastic bottles, products that contain a mixture of different kinds of plastic, metal, glass, and wood. And as a side note, due to Amazon, cardboard use has exponentially increased. So most of our garbage goes through a waste infrastructure, and it's about a $300 billion U.S. dollar industry. Ultimately, though, anything that has value is recovered at one of these recovery facilities. Like I said, they sort all the paper and the cardboard and metals, glass, and plastics and wood. And the volume of material these facilities can sort is ridiculously huge. Like these facilities are piling through all of our garbage. If you think about the amount of garbage that we produce and the fact that it is all being handled on some level, that is a very impressive infrastructure. So what I think, if you're interested, you could see the inner workings of these facilities on YouTube. They're pretty impressive and also pretty alarming. So pre-2018.
That would be 2017.
Right. So pre-2018, from there, the sorted material went through a complicated series of brokers and traders and eventually was sold because, like I said, a whole bunch of cardboard and paper does have a value because mills can repurpose it and use the raw material, use it kind of as a raw material to make new paper. And again, pre-2018, about half of paper and cardboard and two-thirds of plastic was shipped to Europe and Asia for the actual recycling. Paper and cardboard went to paper mills, glass is washed and reused or melted. Metals are melted, plastics are cleaned, melted, and end up as little beads that they would sell. Perishables are burned or buried. After 2018, you guys might know this, some of you might not, but hold on, this is a big one. China no longer purchased several kinds of recyclables, but particularly plastics. But because of that, the value of used plastic dropped to below the value that they'd get for it, meaning it was easier to just get rid of it and not recycle it than it was to try to sell it because its value just went away. So the US and the UK now ship all of their plastics and other things that they can't hawk to other countries where it's burned or buried and very likely finds its way into the ocean. And this is totally pathetic. And scientists have been trying to come up with solutions, right? Multiple solutions for lots of different recycling issues. But finally, scientists have developed a new type of plastic that could potentially solve a significant percentage of the plastic problem. Now, Steve, this is where you insert the cheering, right? Right over that sentence, because if this pans out, which it seems like it will, this is actually a big news item. So plastic is a significant problem because it's difficult to break down. And when it is broken down, the processes that we have today, it weakens the chemical structure of the plastic. So from then on, that recycled plastic is considered low quality and is only used to make inexpensive products. Eugene Chen at Colorado State University, and of course his fellow researchers, have produced a new type of plastic. The material is named PBTL, and it's made of combining chemical building blocks named bicyclic thiolactones. You ever eat any of these guys? Because you shouldn't. No, but the researchers found that the PBTL, it's strong, it's tough, and it's stable, which are three very important properties for plastic. And this translates it into being able to be used in high-end, high-performance plastic products, for example, car parts, construction products, you know, things that you would find in the home, like fake flooring and whatnot, and sporting equipment, which could be considered a very high-end product that has to go through a lot of stress and reuse. So the novel thing about PBTL is that it can be easily broken down into its chemical building blocks and reassembled again into high-quality plastics. Now, what the researchers discovered, that when the material is heated to 100 degrees Celsius or 212 degrees Fahrenheit for 24 hours, while it's in the presence of a chemical catalyst, the catalyst speeds up the chemical process, if you didn't know what a catalyst is. And after the 24 hours, the PBTL has broken down into its original chemical building blocks with no degrading. This means that the plastic doesn't lose any of its integrity, right? It's
infinitely recyclable.
Yeah. Now, I would be careful to say infinitely because, you know, that's a little, you know, big, that's a big claim. But theoretically, it's infinitely recyclable.
Certainly better than what we have now.
Oh, my God, Evan, I know, right?
Well, at least until our sun goes nova.
There's one caveat, and that's not going to go nova. There's only one caveat, and that is...
God, it's a long time.
Oh, my God, help me.
Welcome to my world, Jay.
Jay, tell me more about the sun going nova. Go ahead.
It'll be cool to look at for about 3 seconds. So the only thing that we have to be concerned about is that PBTL can't be recycled until it is void of any other kinds of plastic. Now, that is...
Oh,
that
right.
I'm not sure how big of a deal that is. I don't know how often they mix plastics. I just don't have the information. I couldn't find it. I would imagine that since they mentioned it, that it is something that happens that they have to either engineer around or they simply just have to be able to get rid of the other plastics, right? Might be more processes and more chemicals, but still.
Yeah.
So to sum this up, I don't know how long it'll be until this is widely used. It's important technology because we're using a natural resource, crude oil. It doesn't replenish. It doesn't grow on trees, right? It's just there. And when it's gone, it's not there anymore. Crude oil is going to run out. So now we have all this unrecycled recycled plastic, and it represents a loss to not just the material, but also the time and energy it takes to create it. So, and it adds to plastic pollution. So when you think about the aggregate benefit of having PBTL, it means that the material won't go away, that we don't lose all the other, it's like all the other uses that we had of it. It's kind of built into the reuse of it. It's all a chain at that point. We're not just getting it, throwing it away, hurting the environment in more ways than one. You burn it, that's terrible. You bury it, it leaches crap into
groundwater,
the ground. And if you just lose track of it, goes into the ocean, fish die, and then it settles at the bottom of the ocean. And before you know it, our planet will be made of plastic, which we don't want. So I'm excited because it seems like this is one of those things that isn't 5 to 10. It seems like it could be 5 to 10 months away, not years. It's something that we should keep an eye on.
Now, in the meantime, we still have to deal with the problems that,
right,
with the current plastic that we have.
Right.
Absolutely.
And that wouldn't solve the problem of not capturing the plastic stream to recycle, right? We only recycle a small percentage of all the plastic that we make.
10%.
Yeah, so what would happen is the whole infrastructure would have to change, which, of course, is going to take time, right? So we do save all that plastic. Imagine if they just did it with bottles, which is like not a high-end plastic. But bottles are the most used plastic that we have today. It's the most waste-driven plastic that we have. If we just use
this, just get rid of those.
Yeah. And we just reclaim them, melt it down, make new bottles, and there you go. Because crude oil is an amazing resource. Like, using it as fuel is not the right way to use that, in my opinion. It's an amazing resource. Like, plastics are hugely beneficial to our society. They can be shaped into almost anything and have all sorts of different types of properties. And just, we have to be smart about this because plastic is a good thing. We just have to use it the right way.
All right. Thank you, brother. Kara.
Yep.
This seems like this is one of those questions that never goes away. I suspect it never will go away. Is honey a cure for the common cold or anything like that?
There is a science-based medicine article that was written by Mark Crislip, like 2012 or something like that, talking about the same topic. So I was like, oh, this has been around a while. But basically, the
2013.
The news... 2013. Okay, yeah. The new news item that I'm touching on is a British Medical Journal evidence-based medicine article called Effectiveness of Honey for Symptomatic Relief in Upper Respiratory Tract Infections, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So we've talked a little bit about reviews and meta-analyses before. This is where a review is where they just go through and they do a deep literature search and they look at all of the different studies that have been presented on a topic and kind of sort them based on which of them are meta-analyses, which are randomized control trials, which have placebos, which don't. And then they sort of summarize where the literature stands. A meta-analysis is a little bit more in depth because they actually will go through and try and find good data, and there are all sorts of different ways to determine whether data is good or not. And then they will actually do further analysis on previous studies. And so they'll actually, it's kind of like a study of all the studies to give like grand outcomes. So obviously it would be really complicated to go through every study that was described in this. So I'm going to give some overarching takeaways. These researchers specifically looked at upper respiratory tract infections. Okay, so that's specific, and we need to keep that in mind. They were looking at anything that kind of falls under the bronchial, nose, sinus, pharynx, larynx, like upper respiratory tract. You know, these are things that are kind of like the common cold. They can be caused by a lot of different things. And one of their outcomes, before we even get to the honey, because I think that's kind of the part that everybody's writing about, but basically what they, one of their biggest outcomes that the researchers were trying to say is, do not prescribe antibiotics for upper respiratory tract infections.
Mm-hmm.
This we've known for a long time. And the reason they're saying that is not because there aren't sometimes bacterial causes, but more often than not, these are virally caused. And more often than not, people go to their doctor and they want medicine. And so the doctor feels pressure to prescribe something or to give them some sort of medical advice. And unfortunately, far too often, doctors prescribe antibiotics for things that are very likely viral. And we know that that's not a, well, what's the harm situation, because we know now about antibiotic-resistant bacterial strains. We've known this for a long time. It's not good to take antibiotics when you don't need them, because it's going to contribute to resistance. So that's one of the big outcomes of this meta-analysis, or at least one of the big recommendations that the researchers made. Don't prescribe antibiotics. Okay, but nobody's writing about that because that's kind of old news. What they are writing about is that the researchers are saying honey seems to be as effective, if not a little more so, than usual remedies. And so what they're saying is that it could be better than usual care, but they're almost exclusively talking about in children. They are referring to some studies that were done on adults. When you look at the systematic review and the meta-analysis, the vast majority of the studies were done on children. Very few were done on adults, and the outcomes of the adult studies are less pointed. And so their real recommendation is that more and better research needs to be done if we want to make any sort of distinction between over-the-counter cough medicine or cough and cold medicine, honey, and placebo. But here's the interesting thing, and this harkens back to a lot of other research articles and science journalism that's been covered for like the past 10 years. So none of this is really that new, I realized as I started to dig into it. But it just seems to be the case that a lot of over-the-counter cough medicines aren't that effective, and they're specifically even less effective on children.
Yeah, so the honey is as effective as something that doesn't work.
Exactly, and that's the thing that's important to remember. Yeah. Well, and I don't know if we should say might as well have water, because there do seem to be some subjective measures that show
like a soothing effect.
Absolutely. And that's really what it is. A lot of these studies, actually, because I dug into some of the individual studies. Well, first of all, a lot of them are actually funded by the honey industry. So that's a big like red flag right there. It doesn't mean that the science is invalid. It just means that you need to have a higher bar at that point. And so one of the biggest studies that was cited several years ago was a big, I think it was an Israeli study where the researchers said honey is significantly more effective, but that was funded by a honey industry, and there were actually kind of like a lot of problems with that study. But there have been some pretty solid studies that have shown either improvement, like if, let's say they've looked at placebo, honey, and over-the-counter treatments, and they've shown that both honey and the over-the-counter treatments were slightly better than placebo, but then there have also been plenty of studies that showed that all three were just as effective. A big problem, too, with the Israeli study is that they compared honey to date syrup. They called date syrup the placebo, which is like really problematic because it's really obviously not honey. You know, it's like, it's not like it's a something that looks, smells, and tastes like honey, but isn't honey. It's something that's kind of similar, but anybody who's ever had honey knows the difference between date syrup and honey. So that's problematic, too, because how do you look at placebo? Because we're not talking about like a honey tablet. We're talking about actually eating honey.
Okay. And so that, a teaspoon or a tablespoon.
Exactly. Or squeezing it out of a little packet or something like that. And
or that
it
bear
does,
with the cone. Yeah.
Yeah, the little squeezy bear. It
the
does
honey
seem
bear?
To be that like researchers and pediatricians who do a lot of pediatric science, it does seem to be the consensus that they often like to, quote, prescribe honey for their pediatric clients or patients who have coughs, because the parents want something. They want to do something. They want to give their kids something. And honey, so long as the child is over 1 year old, we have to be really clear about that, because, you know, under one, you cannot give an infant honey. Like, they could get botulism from it.
Yeah,
it's really right. It's really dangerous. Yeah, so over 1 year. But once they're over 1 year, there seem to be very few side effects of honey, and it does seem to have a, like as you mentioned, Evan, a comforting, soothing quality. Nobody really knows if it comes down to anything that's like antimicrobial in the honey. You know, we do understand that there's some of that, but it doesn't seem to be that we've been able to find that that's the effective reason for it. Same thing. Apparently, there's like. Is it hydrogen peroxide in small quantities in honey? But that doesn't seem to be the effective reason either. It's very likely that it just coats your throat. And like, mm-hmm. I know when I was a singer, I used to do honey lemon all the time. That was my over-the-counter, like, it wasn't really a remedy per se, but it was like drink honey and lemon. Like all singers drink honey and lemon all the time because the lemon would like cut through your phlegm and then the honey would coat your throat so you didn't have a raw throat. And I think if you're coughing all the time, your throat hurts. And if you're a child who's coughing all the time, you can't sleep. And one of the more interesting studies that I saw compared placebo to honey to dextromethorphan, which is DXM, it's like quercetin. I know there's different brand names in different countries, but quercetin, that cough suppressant, to diphenhydramine, which is like Benadryl. And they actually found that there was no improve, like the honey and the dextromethorphan and the diphenhydramine all had the same effect. It was slightly better than placebo, but the dextromethorphan, actually the kids were more, or sorry, the diphenhydramine, the kids were more restless. They couldn't sleep. And in the dextromethorphan, they had more like uncomfortable side effects. So that's kind of one of the real risks is that if the cough medicine doesn't work anyway, but it can cause restlessness, it can cause increased heart rate, it can cause sleeplessness. That's why a lot of pediatricians are recommending honey. So, but I think it's important to remember what Steve said at the beginning. The real outcome of this study is not that honey is awesome at treating coughs. It's that honey seems to be no better than over-the-counter medicine, which also isn't good at treating coughs.
Right.
Yeah.
I haven't bought That's an right. over-counter the medicine for a cough in many years. Long yeah, time.
One of the things I read from a lot of pediatricians is that we have this idea in our minds that coughs last about a week, but coughs that come along with the common cold or with any sort of viral upper respiratory infection often last 2 to 3 weeks. And so I
know,
think there's...
Steve, you've had that. You've suffered long bouts with coughs.
And that's apparently very common. And so we have an anxiety around it. Like, I still have this cough. There must be something very, very wrong. Like, it is important to clear phlegm. It's just a function of if you have a cough that's actually not very productive and it's not doing anything, it's uncomfortable. It keeps you up at night. You want some... rest, just some ease from that. And that's when like drinking tea, putting honey in your tea, taking a spoonful of honey, I don't know, like any of those things can calm you and soothe you, but it's not medicine.
Yeah, just don't confuse it for like actual medicine. And
exactly,
like even, and you also have to consider, like in some countries like Mexico, you can get antibiotics over the counter. I'd rather have people using honey than actual antibiotics for a viral infection.
Well, and that's sure. the main outcome of this huge meta-analysis. I mean, that was their big kind of takeaway. And the unfortunate thing is that everybody's writing, honey is better for you than cough medicine. And it's like, no, that's not what they're saying. They're saying cough medicine's not great. Honey is just as good. So you might as well prescribe at least a child honey or tell a child to use or take honey because it has fewer side effects. But above all, don't prescribe antibiotics for viral infections. That's the main takeaway.
Right. All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Bob, I read this item. I have to say I'm not impressed. But
really?
Tell me what you think about this unlocking super endurance. Tell me about it.
Okay. Curious for your feedback. So in another study designed to ultimately make me superhuman, Harvard researchers have recently elucidated the critical role of a key enzyme, PHD3, that plays in fat metabolism and using that knowledge to significantly increase the endurance in rats in experiments. Can they do that for humans? Is it a good idea? So this is a Harvard University study published in August 4th issue of Cell Metabolism. This news item kind of boils down to the energy that cells use. And for the most part, cells, that means sugars. But that's not all they can use. If nutrients are limited, like let's say if you're starving or running a marathon, cells will flip a switch and start metabolizing fats as an energy source. Now, cells dramatically changing their metabolism on the fly, it's been known in biology for decades, but we still don't fully understand what's going on. And there's lots of good reasons to to really wrap our heads around that for many different things, like diseases, obesity, lots and lots of reasons. So Harvard researchers messed with the cell's ability to switch, and the results were pretty amazing, seemed to me anyway, before Steve threw his two cents in. So the hero of this story is the enzyme prolyl hydroxylase 3, or PHD3. Now, this enzyme determines how many nutrients are available and if there's a sufficient amount. PHD3 puts the brakes on fat metabolism when there is enough nutrients. But if you're doing something like running a marathon or starving yourself because your pandemic diet made you put on 20 pounds, PHD3 is suppressed and fat metabolism takes over, much like CNO fusion predominates in massive stars over the proton-proton chain fusion. So you see, I didn't warn you, but you may be tested on my previous talks at any time. So the study itself started with mouse cells essentially swimming in sugar, lots of sugar available, sugar-rich environment. The researchers saw how PHD3 initiates the process, which is, you know, it involves another enzyme, so it's a little complicated. But the PHD3 kind of initiates a process that slows down the fat metabolism. And when those same cells had little access to the sugars, they saw the opposite happen. Fat metabolism kicked in. So next, they moved to actually living mice, and in this step, they restricted their diets to reproduce a low-sugar environment for them, making them fast, and confirmed that the enzymatic changes that they saw in the cells also was happening in the living mice. They saw how PHD3 restricted, how it went through its routine depending on how much was available. So in the last big step of the study, the researchers made knockout mice where the PHD3 enzyme was not even there. For them, they put them through a varied set of endurance experiments, and the results were not what was expected, and they said that it was seemed pretty dramatic, at least for some specific hallmarks of what we consider to be fitness. Now, these mice were trained to run on a treadmill, and the idea of these mice running on little treadmills with little TVs playing Fox News and MSNBC in front of them was pretty funny visual image.
Yeah.
So what the results that they cataloged here was they boosted their VO2 max, which is VO2 max is a common term in like elite fitness. If you have access to basically expensive equipment, you could have your VO2 max tested. And that's essentially a measure of maximum oxygen uptake during exercise. It's a classic marker of aerobic endurance. The higher your number, the more fit you are. I think an average 20-something in decent shape would have a VO2 max of 25. I don't have right in front of me the actual units. But elite aerobic people can have it in the 90s, mid to upper 90s, which is super high. So if that goes up, I mean, you are more aerobically fit if that number goes up. Bottom line. So, but what else they found is not just a boost in VO2 max in these mice compared to the control group, but they ran 50% farther and 40% longer. So pretty dramatic. Analysis afterwards showed that the mice also had increased rates of fat metabolism, not unexpected, right, given what we've already gone over, and a different metabolic profile. Study senior author Marcia Haggis said, "Our results suggest that PHD3 inhibition in whole body or skeletal muscle is beneficial for fitness in terms of endurance exercise capacity, running time, and running distance. Understanding this pathway and how our cells metabolize energy and fuels potentially has broad applications in biology, ranging from cancer control to exercise physiology." So what does this mean? The endurance upgrade in the mice sure seems real from what I could gather. This was not a subtle improvement. You know, often in classic pseudoscience, there's wiggle room within the noise, right? They claim, look at this. This is significant. This is statistically significant. This seems beyond that. It kind of seems like Mighty Mice to me in some ways. But, you know, of course, there may be side effects that we're unaware of. There may be long-term consequences. Down the line, we may find that this cannot be reproduced in humans because these are mice. They are not humans. And we often see this well before it gets tested deeply in humans. That just does not apply. It happens more often than not. Even if we can make Mighty Bobs, it may not be worth it. It may not be worth it due to those, you know, unforeseen side effects. Also, it's not likely in the extreme that basically suppressing one enzyme would have such an obvious long-term benefit, and evolution hadn't already stumbled upon it millions of years ago. That's a good default stance to take whenever you hear anyone claiming that they have a simple way to greatly improve something biological. That all said, however, this does really did pique my interest because it was a dramatic, it seemed to be a dramatic increase. This was Harvard research, which has its own, you know, pretty decent street cred. So I'm a little bit optimistic here. So we'll see what Steve says. So in closing, in the future, what may we expect? Future studies will certainly see if human cells respond similarly, I would think. And also what potential negative consequences there might be. So, you know, even if human cells respond, they could find that, oh, boy, man, you do this for a few months and this is going to happen and you don't want this to happen. That's why evolution didn't jump on it, because it may have tried and everyone died and couldn't reproduce because of that enzyme wasn't there. Who knows? Other further studies will likely be done to see if this concept could help with muscle function in disease scenarios. For example, the reason why Harvard was even doing this research, because they found that some cancers like leukemia involve mutated cells that have diminished PHD3 activity, and they use fats to grow tumors. So this is one of the reasons why they were even looking at this. So if we have a better understanding, you know, whatever the outcome is, if we have a better understanding of this process, we may be able to. It may help with some types of cancers and even muscle disorders. Who knows what kind of impact this research, if it does pan out, could have on certain muscle disorders. So, I mean, I was a little psyched about it. Steve, what are your thoughts?
Well, you mentioned the things that I was not impressed with. Woo-hoo! That is specifically that it's very unlikely that you're going to,
yes,
you know, alter one enzyme and the system is going to function better.
Right.
Why is that enzyme there in the first place? You know, evolution is actually really good at optimizing systems, you know, where all the pieces are already there. You know, it's quirky when it has to innovate new things. It can do that, but you can't predict that. But right, once you have, it optimizes the pieces that are already there pretty well.
Right.
So why would that be? The only, and again, this study doesn't really establish that. It's preliminary. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it's really, it was a very narrow focus in terms of what they were looking at. They certainly can't rule out that there aren't downstream negative effects to all of this,
which I think is what's going to finally kill this. That's,
yeah, probably. So but if you want to hold on to some hope, the only thing I could think of is that this enzyme represents adaptation to being calorie limited,
yes,
to animals that are living on the brink of starvation, which is like most animals most of the time,
right?
And that for humans, we just don't need it, you know,
which is relatively recent, right, in history.
Yeah, if you're living in a developed nation that has no food insecurity, you may not need this adaptation, so you don't need the trade-offs for it. So that would be the best case scenario.
Okay.
But we don't know, right? That's a lot of unanswered questions. There's this kind of research, the way I see it, is it teaches us something about how the system works, and then the press release has to figure out some way to say this is going to have an application.
Right.
But that is pure, that goes way beyond the science. This could make, you know, whatever, have application in people or whatever.
So it's not good enough that it's just academic or,
yeah,
know, for
how about,
furthering our knowledge.
How about now we understand this?
Nope, sorry, yeah, that's not dramatic enough. That won't sell anything.
That's right.
Mighty mice.
Discovered.
It's always strained, though. And sometimes it's incredibly strained.
Yeah, I mean, one thing they could have stressed, if they stressed the fact that, you know, we've seen this type of inhibition in some leukemias, and this could help us get a better handle on what's going on in those disease conditions, and that wouldn't be a reach to make that kind of speculation.
Yeah.
But yeah, super mice and, I mean, super humans, you know, with double the endurance, yeah, that's definitely going ahead of it a bit, but it's, you can't help but go there mentally. And I mean, and it was, Steve, this was kind of dramatic compared to the controls. You know, a 50% increase is pretty stark, and not like, oh, they screwed up, they missed a decimal point type of thing.
There's definitely something happening.
Yeah, so I'm just curious to see what kind of downstream effects this might have on those mice. I wonder how those mice are, those knockout mice. How are they right now? What's going on with those mice right now? They're just like, there's this, like, boiling away in the corner.
Bob.
Exploding.
Bob, those mice are not alive anymore. You know that, right?
No, they brought them back.
Little.
Like, unfortunately.
I don't know. If I made a Mighty Mice in the lab, I'd take him home.
And your
little
university
cape on.
Would, yeah, you'd get in a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next news item, which is really cool. This has to do with mass extinction.
Yeah.
What do you guys
think? Why is that
like
cool?
Mass extinction.
Yeah, that's depressing.
So there have been, hey, we wouldn't be here without them. There have been a lot of mass extinctions throughout the Earth's history, but there are five big ones, right? The five big mass extinctions, global extinctions. The first one was the Ordovician-Silurian extinction 444 million years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah. Probably caused by global cooling, resulting in increased polar ice, dropping the ocean level. The ocean became toxic. Oxygen levels dropped. 85% of species were lost. Then there's the late Devonian extinctions, 383 to 359 million years ago. This was a series of extinctions, but with the most dramatic one causing a loss of 70 to 80% of species. We don't really understand that one as well. I'm going to come back to that one because that's the news item. Then there's the Permian-Triassic extinction, 250 million years ago. This was the Great Dying. Over 96% of sea species, 75% of land animal species went extinct.
Not a good time. Not a good time.
Yeah. Probably due to global warming from volcanic activity is the short answer. And then the Triassic-Jurassic extinction, 201 million years ago. There was, again, global warming, significant atmospheric CO2 increased by a factor of 4. Probably also caused by volcanic activity.
Are those flood basalt volcanoes, Steve? Or
this was the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province. Oh, you ever heard of that?
No.
What the hell is that? Yeah.
Sounds awesome and scary.
Camp, C-A-M-P.
Magmatic Province. Yeah, so it was, again, this is, I think, Pangaea, you know, and it was just a massive rift in the middle of Pangaea. With lava and CO2 pouring out over thousands of years. And then there was the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction 66 million years ago. That's the one that wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs
that everybody knows about.
Probably due to primarily to a asteroid impact, although the minority opinion is that maybe the Deccan Trap eruptions had something to do with it as well.
Those are flipped.
So those are the five big ones. One impact, two global warming. One global cooling, we're not really sure. So let's go back to that late Devonian extinctions, 383 to 359. So what do we do know? What do we know? We know that these extinctions correlate with a dramatic decrease in ocean oxygenation. And when I say dramatic, I mean in some locations and times, there was no detectable oxygen, like there was no oxygen in the water. But we don't know what caused that specifically.
All the candidates are there. Leaching into the ocean like a...
Yeah, probably.
Algae blooms and stuff.
Yeah, so that is one of the sequences that they're talking about, that there was increased flow of nutrients from the land to the ocean that led to algae blooms, which then led to dead zones of no oxygen. That could have been caused simply by plants evolving on land, developing into trees, you know, which would then greatly accelerate the erosion of the land, and then therefore nutrients flowing into the ocean. But also haven't ruled out an asteroid impact, and there's some asteroid craters that correlate with some of these extinctions. Volcanic eruptions are all on the line. But now a new paper adds another one to the list, a nearby supernova explosion.
Ooh, how near?
So that's a good question. So they say it would not be in the kill zone, right? So
obviously,
the supernova itself didn't kill all life on Earth, but it probably was close, like 60 to 70 light years.
Wow,
pretty
man.
Close.
You imagine?
We would have seen that.
Yeah.
Wait, the kill zone? Would you say? I don't understand that, Steve.
So the kill zone would be like a supernova within like 5 light years that would just wipe out.
Scour the Earth.
There'd be too much ionizing radiation. Nothing would survive.
That's like a reboot scenario.
Yeah. This is at like 60 light years, which was close enough that ionizing radiation could have destroyed the ozone layer. And that could have then led downstream to the extinction events by changes in the atmosphere, the chemistry, and then subsequently the oxygenation of the oceans.
Wow.
So I think the basic sequence would have been the ionizing radiation, increasing surface temperatures, which increased water vapor in the stratosphere, which led to an increase in free radical formation, which then chemically degraded the ozone.
See, that's not the kill zone. That's the lame zone. I mean, you got a nearby supernova, and it's getting hotter. It's a little bit hotter. It's like, oh, come on, give me something more dramatic.
Yeah, but like 85% of species.
You know, that's dramatic.
That's pretty dramatic.
But you said, Steve, there are other
things. It's more humid. It's more humid.
So this is... So, Steve, is this considered now one component of that extinction?
Yeah.
Not necessarily the primary cause.
Well, see, we're talking a series of extinctions, right?
This is it was a series of extinctions, but it might have been the triggering event, you know, that set up the conditions that allowed for the series of extinctions. But again, it's like the one that we know the least about, so there's still a lot of possibilities, but this is an interesting addition to that. But what it made me think about, and I think we've touched upon this previously on the show, is what is the threat of supernova to life in the galaxy, to life on Earth? Fortunately, we're not near any stars that are going to go supernova, at least no time soon. Probably the nearest one is Betelgeuse, which is 600 light years away, which would not touch us.
Oh, man, I want to see that so badly.
It'd be pretty. But wouldn't affect us. That's 10 times further away. But if you were, the closer you are to the center of your galaxy where there's higher density of stars, or if you're in a globular cluster, for example, the more densely packed your neighborhood is with other stars, the more likely it is that, you know, the more frequent you will experience close supernova. And so what would that do to life on any planet in a system that's densely packed? And of course, you also get your occasional gamma ray bursts, which could sterilize the planet, strip the atmosphere from it, and make it so that no life will ever be there again.
Yeah, here's a laser beam a light year wide.
So that makes those less likely candidates for, host planets for life and other things, or advanced life.
But those are the locations that have the higher metallicity stars, are the ones that are more likely to form life in the first place because they have the heavier elements. So it seems like there's this sweet spot where you're just close enough to the galactic center that you have high enough metallicity, but far enough away that you're not going to get routinely scoured by supernova or gamma ray bursts. And that's where we are. We're kind of in a galactic Goldilocks zone.
Location.
But I don't think that we are in the most optimal place for the prospects of long-term life.
What do you mean by long-term?
Like billions of years, right? That's the whole idea. We want life to survive for over billions of years. Where do you think that would be?
In the ocean.
Further out?
Further away from the center? A rogue planet.
Well, what's that?
Intergalactic stars.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
So
non-galaxy stars.
Yeah. And do you remember what percentage, Kara, what percentage of stars in the universe do you think are intergalactic versus, you know, tied up in the gravity of a galaxy?
I can guess.
Smaller percentage?
what do you think, Bob?
It's more. It's a lot more. Right?
Oh, it's more?
50, it's 50%. It's 50%.
Oh, it's half and half. Look at us, Bob. We're both wrong, right?
If you look at, and this is based upon, like, if you just look at the mass of stuff out there, that the visible stars account for about half of it. So they think that, well, there's also this glow, like there's this intergalactic glow, which if you add it all up, it's like, all right, there's as many stars in between the galaxies as there are in galaxies.
Was I thinking of rogue planets, Steve? I think there's a lot more rogue planets.
Yeah, but rogue planets... Or just don't have they're cold, right? They don't have a star to keep them warm.
But that doesn't mean there can't be any life.
That's true. But they also could
radioactive.
You also don't want to be bouncing around. You know, you don't want to get hit by. That's the other thing is that the closer you are to the galaxy center, the more likely you are to get hit by a rogue planet. You don't want that.
Yeah, but don't forget, we are not far from a point in time where we could basically survive almost any existential threat.
Mm-hmm.
Anything from a coronal mass ejection to a rogue planet to anything except maybe, a really nearby gamma ray burst. But even then, if you had enough lead time, you could get a few light years away, you could be probably okay. So, so we're near that window. Relatively speaking, we're damn close. I mean, it could be, a couple centuries. But that's nothing.
Yeah.
All right. But listen to this. Most of those intergalactic stars come from galaxies. They didn't form out there
they got
in
ejected.
The void.
They broke
they
away
ejected.
Upon it.
They voted off
so
the island.
So think about it. That's the best case scenario. You have most stars in a galaxy are going to be in the tightly packed region, the high metallicity area. And then a lot of those stars get flung out into the intergalactic space where they're safe.
Yeah, but you forget the downside, man. They got a horrible night sky.
Not if you have a galaxy rise.
Well, all right, that's true.
So it might be statistically that most of the life in the universe is on intergalactic stars rather than galactic stars.
Yeah.
Because those are the ones that have all the good features and are safe by distance from getting scoured by radiation. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's cool.
We just don't think of there being 50% of all the stars out there being not part of galaxies.
Yeah.
Wonder what that would do to your culture to see this awesome galaxy rise, and that's it. No other stars except this galaxy that rises and sets.
That'd be cool.
And like, why
you
were
would
we
worship the galaxy?
Yeah,
God.
Why aren't we there? Why were we kicked out?
Right, Bob. And I haven't. I've never read personally. No. Been exposed to any science fiction that deals with intergalactic stars.
Let's talk to Brian Trent. Talk to Brian Trent.
Time to write that.
Yeah, there would be. That would be like the intergalactic civilization would be there. And like going into a galaxy, what the hell are you going to do that for?
Boy, you better get along with your neighboring planets and stuff and other species and things, because you got only one shot at making it all work out. If you screw yourselves up, you might be done.
Well, I mean, certainly you're a lot farther away from your closest neighbors. But honestly, does it really matter that much? Because, you know, even 4 light years away is still completely inaccessible in any kind of realistic time frame.
And imagine you're near the core, and it's like a quarter of a light year away, which I think on average is what it would be. That's tantalizingly close. Still crazy far, but a quarter of a light year isn't much. But you're in the core. You're going to get fried eventually.
Yeah, regular basis. All right, Jay, who's that noisy time?
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy.
It has almost like a lion's growl or roar to me in a certain way. It's something from the throat of an animal.
Now I'm hearing something spinning up, like rotating, and then engaging with something else, which causes it to slow down, but you're also hearing the interaction of the two.
That's an interesting guess, Steve. So Visto Tutti, he said, I can hear a mechanical pump, then some spurts of slurring going down the pipe. So I'm guessing it's a space toilet, the most important machine on the space station.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that and the oxygen, and then, you know, but yes.
do you guys remember last week or 2 weeks ago, I said that somebody, you know, told us what Visto Tutti means?
To see everything.
Yeah, see it all.
Right. So he wrote, you know, Visto Tutti, the guy himself wrote in and said, It has an idiomatic meaning like the English phrase, all of the above.
Oh.
Right. Yeah.
And okay. He says, I don't think my parents fully understood the English birth registrar form. I don't know if he's kidding or if that's true, but maybe his name really is just something on the, you know, that was under like a drop down. You know what I mean?
All of the above. Wow. Yeah.
All right. So Adam Hepburn wrote in and said, hey, Jay, I have a guess for episode 789. Who's that noisy? Factoring in the background sounds, the main sound to me is an animal snoring, possibly partially submerged, which makes me think it's a hippopotamus.
Okay. See, I thought animal too.
Or just a really cool opotamus.
Why? Oh, 2 weeks ago was why was 6 afraid of 7? Seriously?
789?
Yeah. That we should have been celebrating.
You're right.
Oh,
that's a very exciting number.
We missed that.
Sorry. I just heard you say it out loud, and it hit me, because I would never... Yeah. Anyway,
last week's was 789. This is 790. Ugh. 790, we're getting close to 800.
Oh, my gosh.
That's banana.
800.
Oof. It's a good number.
All right, Mark Constantine wrote in. He said, hi, any chance this week's noisy is the sound of a tidal energy electric generator? It sounds like a propeller of some sort getting spun up as the tide runs through it, hence the back and forth sound of water and the machine noise. It also sounds like it's half out of the water, which I've got no explanation for, but the rest of it fits my mind's logic. So, Mark, I gave you extra points because your half out the water thing is on the right track. Mm-hmm. Here's a close guess from Jody Lesko. Jody said, hi, Jay and crew. Thought I Though I want it to be an alligator growling, I am going to guess that this week's Noisy is an indoor water rowing machine. Okay, so here's this week's winner, Richard Smith. He said, that sounds like an alligator bellowing just under the surface, making the water dance. So this has never happened before. I've never had anybody. So remember, Jody just said, though I want it to be an alligator growling, here's what I think the real answer is. And she named an indoor rowing machine. She guessed it, but then unguessed it. So
that's me every week at Science or Fiction.
You can't be in more second place than Jody, because she dangled it there and took it away. But I had to mention her because she said it. So good guess, Richard. This is an alligator. This is one of the noises that an alligator, or I think a crocodile, can make a similar noise. I think it's related to a mating ritual, but it's really weird. They stick their head way up, pointing up kind of on an angle to the sky, and it's out of the water quite a bit. And then there's a pause, and then the alligator just vibrates its body. And you know the bumps on the alligator's back?
Mm-hmm. The gingerbread.
They're just barely sticking out of the water, and the water looks like it's coming up and down really fast. It looks like water being vibrated really severely, which it is. And that's where the sound comes from. So let's listen to that again. So it is a combination of the growl of the alligator and the vibration of the water.
Cool.
And again, this noisy was sent in by a listener named Dan A. And he didn't say anything other than it must have been used for the Jurassic Park production. And I wouldn't doubt it. It's a fantastic noisy to sound to mess with to make it sound like a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. All right, I have a new noisy this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Michael Jack, and here it is.
Okay.
No clues, no nothing. What is that? What's happening? Mm-hmm. You got to email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right, thanks, Jay. We're going to do one email. This one comes from Matthew, doesn't give a location. And Matthew writes, lately I've been seeing ads for this product plastered all over my social media. It claims to help you fall asleep by vibrating the skin on your ankle. They also make a lot of claims about being developed by top neuroscientists and being backed by research and clinical trials that they're conveniently not allowed to share just yet. Is there any plausibility to this at all, or is it total BS? Well, Matthew, if you have to ask, it's probably total BS. Mm. But on closer inspection, it is total BS. So this is, you know, this is the kind of stuff that drives me crazy, right? You know, the idea that you're going to, like, you have different settings that are going to vibrate on some frequency, and it's going to basically train your body into whatever, you know, you want. It's not just for sleeping, you know. It's good for, you could put, you know, reduce stress or...
It says here, Steve, when used consistently, Apollo retrains your nervous system to manage stress more effectively on your own.
So there's a couple of clicks removed from actual science. And this is a very common thing that they do. So they're talking about top neuroscientists and clinical trials. It has nothing to do with their product. It has to do with this two steps removed thing that they're hitting, that they're just, you know, exploiting in order to lend some credibility to their device. They're talking about heart rate variability, which I think I've spoken about before. So heart rate variability is just what it sounds. It's like, you know, when your heart beats from beat to beat, there's a little bit of variability in the time between one beat to the next. That's because your heart rate is being constantly pushed and pulled by your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, both part of the autonomic nervous system. So there should be this ebb and flow to your heart rhythm as it's adjusting for your breathing and your, you know, standing up, getting down, bearing down, whatever, all those things, how much physical activity you're doing is going to alter your heart rate. So there should be this constant meandering heart rate variability, right? Now, something like 30 years ago was like the first studies looking at heart rate variability. The idea is a simple one. If there's this balance between parasympathetic and sympathetic forces in your autonomic nervous system, what if there's autonomic disorder? What if you have one of those is overactive or underactive? Like, for example, if your sympathetic nervous system is pegged all the way at maximum, then your heart rate variability should decrease, right? Because you're not meandering in the middle of the zone. You're already pushed up against one end of the zone. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this has been studied for years now, the use of heart rate variability to diagnose autonomic dysfunction. And it's one of those things. So I looked carefully at that literature, and I've looked at it previously, but there's definitely some legitimacy to it. I think it's basically valid. I just don't know that it's a home run, to be honest with you, because a lot of the data seems kind of close to the line. But let's say that as far as that goes, it's perfectly legitimate. Using just that one claim, using heart rate variability to diagnose autonomic dysfunction, that's the legitimate science that they're then now exploiting to prop up their pseudoscience. Because here's the two clicks they're going away from it. One is to say that heart rate variability can be used to diagnose stress specifically, not just autonomic dysfunction, but just you're under stress. And therefore, your sympathetic nervous system is more active, and therefore your heart rate variability is going to go down. Again, that's not crazy implausible. It's just not what's been established by the scientific evidence, right? Mm-hmm. But then here's the massive leap that they make, that therefore, and this is also a very common approach, therefore, if heart rate variability is a marker of stress, we can reverse the stream, right? And we could reduce your stress by altering this marker of stress. Mm. So that's a very common strategy in pseudoscience. It's like, oh, your EEGs look this way when you're calm, so we're going to force your EEG to look this way and you'll be calm. No, it doesn't work that way. You can't just reverse the arrow of causation. You can't just put a vibration on your ankle and it's going to somehow train your heart rate to put you in a different state of stress. You know, so that's the... So there's one small step and one giant leap beyond the actual scientific evidence firmly into the zone of pure pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. And what they never have, what companies like this never have, again, they try to say it's scientifically backed, developed by neuroscientists. They're talking about the basic science that has nothing to do with the claims that they're making. What hasn't been tested is their actual clinical claims.
Right.
Right? We don't have any objective, peer-reviewed, double-blind data that is convincing. They may or may not bother to do in-house studies, which are totally worthless, or they just will cite existing literature that they had nothing to do with and say, look at all these studies which show that our stuff is science-y, So that's what they're doing here, but this is nonsense from beginning to end.
These kinds of websites have certain... Boy, you don't want to judge books by their covers, but I've looked at wearables. I've been reporting several times over the last couple of years about them. I don't know if there's one company out there designing their web pages for all these companies, but they all have very similar looks, feels, production qualities, click-throughs, graphics, simple. It has that feel.
Totally.
And you can't judge it by that. But each time I've looked into one of these, and that is the result, is that the science is not there. This is how this device, this package, and this website looks, right in line with the other ones.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for that, Matthew.
Steve.
Yeah.
Before we go to science or fiction,
mm-hmm.
You and I were discussing earlier how we are at an intersection right now, a very important time in the United States. And we have a simple message that we wanted to discuss with our audience, and that is basically that please take what's happening seriously. Go register to vote. Check to make sure you're registered to vote. And please try to get other people to vote.
Yeah, so all we're asking you to do is just, first of all, to vote, but to make sure that you can vote. This, obviously, we're talking to our American listeners. But, of course, in any country, vote, if you're allowed to. But we have an important election coming up. So if you go to vote.org, you can check your registration. You can register to vote. You can vote, request a ballot if you want to by mail. You can also find your polling place locator. So all the information that you need to make sure that you can vote is there. In some places, depending on what state you live in, where you live, if you may be registered now, but find that you're not registered 30 days from now because they purged the polls or something. If you've moved, if you've had a change of address or anything like that, Check now, check before the election with enough time to make sure that you're all registered and ready to go. That's it. Just a public service announcement to vote and how to do that. Vote.org is really like the one-stop shopping for everything you need. All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have another theme this week, which we usually do when we're recording early because there hasn't been a long enough news cycle to find three news items. So the theme this week is bird misconceptions.
Oh, great.
So these are three things that you may have heard about birds.
I heard bird is the word.
But one of these things is not true for some reason. There's a misconception in one of these items somewhere. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Birds' knees do not bend backward relative to humans. The backward bending joint is, in fact, their ankle. Item number two, birds are unable to digest rice, which will collect and expand in their GI system, potentially leading to death. And item number three, penguins are found only in the southern hemisphere, but in many locations, including in the Galapagos, near the equator. Jay, go first.
All right, this first news item, Steve, birds' knees do not bend backwards relative to humans. The backward bending joint is, in fact, their ankle. Now, you know I own a bird, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very well aware of his feet and the strangeness of his feet. So I'm visualizing that foot right now. And you're saying that the joint is the ankle. I mean, it seems to make sense, but I'm thinking of the physiology of birds is very different than humans. But all right, I'm not sure about that one. I'm going to move on to the next one. Birds are unable to digest rice. Oh my God, talk about like an urban legend. Yeah, people stop. We're saying don't have birds eat raw rice, uncooked rice, because it'll swell up in their stomach. I don't know if you're talking about cooked or not cooked rice, Steve.
You know, this refers to uncooked rice.
Okay. So, you know, that is the what people do when they just throw bird seed now at weddings. So, oh my God, you know, believe urban legend versus, oh my God. All right. So that one is a possible truth. Penguins are found only in the southern hemisphere, but in many locations, including the Galapagos, near the equator. I've also heard this, and I'm so angry that I just don't have more information in my head about that. So I'm going to say that the penguins one is the fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Well, the penguins one being the fiction, Jay, found only in the southern hemisphere, but in many locations. We saw penguins when we went to New Zealand.
That's right.
And that was awesome. It really was. It's one thing to see them in a zoo, but another thing to see them just, you know, swimming in nature, just two entirely different experiences, by the way. Go see them. Now, Steve, I imagine we're talking about not in captivity.
Of course.
With this one. Okay, right. Because, you know, obviously that would immediately make this one the fiction. But the one I'm concerned with, and I've always had a problem with this, is the rice one, unable to digest rice, the uncooked rice. I mean, and that it would like blow up in their stomachs, kind of expand as if it was cooking in their stomachs. That never made sense to me. Aren't there acids and thing in the bird's stomach that would break it down like it does all the other things that it eats? And it eats hard stuff and other things that would otherwise maybe potentially do the same thing that rice would otherwise doing, according to the claim. So that one has never sat right with me. So because I'm going to go with my gut and say birds are able to digest rice. I think that one's the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
All right. So the birds' knees, I do know that there's some animal. Oh, you know what it is? Elephants. Elephants walk on their toes. That's the memory I'm thinking of. But does the same thing apply to birds? See, now, crap, it's in fact, but still, I think that there might be something to that. Damn. Let's see, the rice thing, yeah, I don't know. I just don't know one way or the other whether it could easily be a myth or there might be some science behind it. And penguins, That's how you pronounce it. It's not penguin. Penguins.
Penguin.
At least that's how Cumberbatch says it. I'm going to defer to him.
Benedict Cumberbatch.
Hilarious video. If you've, let's see. I'm going to go with Jay. Jay, me and you, bro. Penguins. Oh, fiction. Wow.
All right, Aunt Kara.
So you guys may have heard me use the words on the show before, plantigrade and digitigrade.
Yes.
Yeah.
So a plantigrade is an animal that walks on its foot, and a digitigrade walks on its toes. And there are actually a lot of animals for whom the back legs look like they bend backward, right? And that's because that's actually its ankle. Its foot is the lower part of what looks like the leg. And then their knee is way up high. So I'm pretty sure birds fall in that category. I'm going to say that one's science. And penguins is, I'm kind of torn between the penguin. Rice and the penguins one. And penguins. I've seen penguins in Australia. I was lucky enough to see penguins in the Galapagos too, which is weird because it's hot there.
It's so cool.
I saw the tiny, when you guys were in New Zealand, did you see the tiny penguins or little penguins? That's what they're called. The little blue ones. Do you remember?
They had a yellow feature, didn't they?
Oh, okay. I know which ones you're talking about. So when I was in Australia, I got to see the little penguins, which are so cute. They're like a foot tall, and they come out of the ocean at the same time every night, and they fall down because they have little sea legs. It's very sweet. But I'm pretty sure there aren't any penguins in the northern hemisphere. I know here I wanted to go see puffins. And a lot of the people I talked to were like, oh, I've never seen a penguin. And I was like, oh, I've never seen a puffin. And I think that might be a hemispheric divide there. And the rice one just sounds like a myth to me. Actually, I've never heard of that. So you said it was an old wives' tale. I've never heard that wives' tale. Yeah. But I assume it's common knowledge. And my guess is that it's commonly unfactual knowledge.
All right. So we got an even split, but you guys all agree on number one. So we'll start there. Birds' knees do not bend backward. Relative to humans, the backward bending joint is, in fact, their ankle. You all think this is science, and this one is science. Yeah, this is the giveaway, but it's a fun thing to talk about. Yeah, so you're correct, Karen. I remember that you did talk about these words, which is why I had you go last.
Yeah.
birds are digitigrade. They are digitigrade, which means they walk on their toes.
It's so fun to say.
And what you think of as their knee is their ankle, right? The lower part's their foot, the upper part is their like tibia, and then their actual knee is way up under their wings, you know. So you don't really see them very much. But also, lots of dogs and cats are digitigrade too, right?
Yeah,
and what? So are werewolves.
Their knees look backward too on the back legs. They look backward.
Yeah, like Bob. Remember in American Werewolf in London when. Oh. The foot increases so much.
And
humans are plantigrade. We walk on our feet. Mm.
Ooh, a good example of that was from the movie I just watched, Pan's Labyrinth, the Fawn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he really bends backward in that cool way.
Yeah. Creepy.
Yeah, yeah. So the question is, is the rice thing an urban legend or is it like a recommendation from actual scientists? And did penguins ever manage to make it north of the equator and colonize anything in the northern hemisphere? Let's go to number two. Birds are unable to digest rice, which will collect and expand in their GI system, potentially leading to death. Kara and Evan, you think this one is fiction. Bob and Jay, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
The fiction. Sorry, brothers.
All these years.
Evan, you are correct. This one is total nonsense. It was completely made up, but Jay's correct. This is like standard procedure now, at least in our area. Like everyone uses birdseed, no more rice, based upon this false belief that birds magically can't digest rice. When, do you see the shit that birds eat? They eat all seeds and everything. Why would they not be able to? In fact, there are wild birds that live on wild rice. It's a food. They digest it just fine. There is like no reason not to feed birds rice.
But don't say that to us like we're stupid, okay?
I'm just saying it is an urban legend. It's out there. We've been told that our whole lives, or at least for a large part of it.
Like since the 80s at least.
Yeah, but it has zero basis in reality. Just one of those things. Somebody made it up and then it just got legs and there you go.
There you go. 10% of the brain kind of thing out there.
And then everyone's trying to be responsible. Yeah. Ooh, don't use rice, you know, but it just doesn't make any sense. All right.
Ooh, you're throwing rice. All the birds.
Which means that penguins are found only in the Southern Hemisphere, but in many locations, including in the Galapagos near the equator, is science. Now, you know, the thing is, that's what everyone says, that's what every resource says, but I have to wonder, did no penguin on the Galapagos ever manage to swim across the equator?
Oh, I'm sure. I think there's part survive. Of the Galapagos is north of the equator.
Yeah, it's
it?
On the equator,
like a tip.
Right?
Yeah.
But I guess they count that on the equator, so they don't count that as being in the Northern Hemisphere. But yeah, they are a Southern Hemisphere-only animal, which is a mistake that I see made frequently, you know, in showing, like, the big thing is showing polar bears and penguins together.
Right.
No, polar bears are exclusively Arctic, and penguins are exclusively Southern Hemisphere. And never the twain shall meet.
Oh my
yeah,
so. Wow, I love that.
So that's it. But yeah, so that one is true. That is a something you hear that is actually correct. So that was fun. Good job, Evan and Kara.
Yeah, birds.
Yeah,
whatever.
I'm going out to throw rice.
The fun thing is, Jay, I always win no matter what happens. So that's good.
I mean, isn't it amazing, though? Like, you know, the rice thing is such a strong, powerful example of bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Like, at some point in time, a TV show or somebody said to you, oh, yeah, birds, you know, they'll die if you throw rice at a wedding. And it just goes in and it stays there and it's a fact.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why it's good to question everything, even things that you've – you hear it from, like, pseudo-authoritative sources too, you know, but they are just repeating the urban legend themselves. Just takes
and
on
especially
a life
if you're young, like before you've developed a critical mind, that stuff's sort of locked in and you got to go revisit it later.
You have to unlearn it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, when you do think it through, like Evan did, it's like, yeah, why wouldn't they just digest it?
Right? Yeah. They have stomach acid, like, don't they?
Yeah, but you could say maybe they don't have the enzymes. You know, not everyone digests everything.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
But birds,
you know,
why would it expand?
You hear things like, never feed a dog chocolate. What? They can't digest chocolate? I mean, you never know what animal could be intolerant to some food item.
No, it's true.
Crazy.
But chocolate contains compounds. It's not that they can't digest the chocolate. It contains things that are poisonous to them. So it's not that rice is poisonous to birds. The claim is that it's indigestible. It just expands and it causes obstruction. And, you know, but, you know, rice is a pretty basic grain. You know, birds eat grains. That's like one of their staples, you know. So, right, they eat seeds and grains and all that kind of stuff. So, when you really think about it, it doesn't make any sense. And in fact, it's not true. All right. Evan, give us a quote.
Open-mindedness is about being open to changing your mind in light of new evidence. It's about detaching from your beliefs and focusing on unbiased thinking void of self-interest. It's about being open to constructive criticism and new ideas. People who are skeptical do all of this as well. They challenge ideas and they withhold judgment until sufficient evidence is provided. They are open to all possibilities until sufficient evidence is presented. And that was written by Christopher Dwyer, who is the author of the book Critical Thinking, Conceptual Perspectives, and Practical Guidelines.
Yep, nice. That's a great quote. I've encountered and written myself many variations of that. What I like to say to people, because, you know, just about 100% of the time when somebody is asking me to be open-minded, they're defending nonsense,
right?
That's pretty much a one-to-one correlation there. And then always they're the ones who are not being open-minded, like almost always. Mm-hmm. And so I like to come back. One of my favorite rejoinders is, yes, I'm open-minded. Are you open-minded to the possibility that you're wrong? It seems like the only thing you're open to is the possibility that you're correct. How about being open to the possibility that you're wrong? Doesn't that involve being open-minded as well? And how are we going to, you're trying to lead them ultimately to, like, how are we going to resolve this? You have to, you know, logic and evidence, et cetera, critical thinking. But they invoke being open-minded as it's like a virtue. Like, you have to be open. It's like having faith. Like, don't think, just be open.
Right.
Don't think.
No.
Feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you always come back with, have an open mind, but not so open your brains fall out.
Yeah.
I'd love that.
It's true. Yeah.
But it is true.
You got to be open-minded and skeptical to be a good scientist.
Exactly.
You need both
things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it,
thanks,
brother.
Thank you, Steve.
And we will, as always, now we will see you on Friday at the live stream. Kara, are you going to be available for the live stream on Friday?
I will try because I'm actually not flying tomorrow. I'm flying like butthole early on Thursday morning, which is why I couldn't record, you know, at butthole late on Wednesday night.
Gotcha.
So I don't get home until late Thursday night. So we'll just see how if I'm awake. I'll be there on Friday.
You'll
see
be
how
massively
jet lag is kicking me in the butt.
Oh boy. I hope
massively jet lag.
I hope you'll be there.
Yeah. I will work hard to drink coffee.
Well, I'll see whoever shows up on Friday at the live stream. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.